Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, May 22nd, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, sitting in for Mike McKean. Here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, it's nearly 2 years to the day after an F5 tornado nearly destroyed Joplin. Another band of storms wreaks havoc on the town of Moore, Oklahoma, killing more than two dozen, injuring several school, including several school children. The Obama administration still on the defensive as new details unfold in three crises that continue to grip the headlines. We'll talk about what's gone on in the past week and how those developments have been reported in the national press. Big layoffs at ESPN, the profitable sports and entertainment network, cut about 400 jobs, its first measurable staff reduction since 2009. And up in Toronto, journalists caught wind of a video recording of Mayor Rob Ford apparently smoking crack cocaine. And the folks who have that tape are willing to give it up for $200,000. Several news organizations are considering ponying up the cash. We'll talk about the ethics of that. First, it's springtime in the Midwest, and that means powerful tornadoes. Monday afternoon, an F5 storm ripped through the town of Moore, Oklahoma, about halfway between Oklahoma City and Norman. As of right now, there are 24 who have been confirmed dead, several of those school children who drowned in the basement of the Plaza Towers Elementary School. News coverage of the storm was immediate, and it was in real time.
Let me zoom in here. And look at that school. Look at that school, guys. Oh, my God. Right there. Keep coming back to your left, Travis. Keep coming back to your left. If you guys can see this, I don't know how to explain it, how to describe it. This is terrible. This is war zone terrible. This school is completely gone. Now we're going to stay right here. It's right to the right. If you'll pan back to the right, you're going to see the school. That was it right there. That's what's left of it.
That was John Welsh reporting for Oklahoma City's CBS affiliate, KFOR. Ernest, aerial video was the story here this week.
It just shows that oftentimes, especially in weather coverage, television is the best medium because it gets there immediately. You see what's going on, and the public gets an idea of just how powerful these storms can be. As a reporter, early in my career, I covered tornadoes, I covered hurricanes, and being on the ground and actually being able to see it, it's very hard to describe that in words and be as immediate as television can be.
There's actually another video clip that's on our links blog of John Welsh describing what it was like to be flying over, especially because his home is in Moore, and to see what it was like at that point. Some are actually saying, including Victor Hernandez, one of our colleagues at CNN, that he was kind of recognizing this as being the first time since Katrina that we saw the devastation unfold live on TV, and that that was in 2005, a full year before Twitter. Now we're also experiencing that second screen experience in reporting online and in social media as well. How has technology been a big game changer in that way, Lee?
The first technology that was a big game changer was television. And what the scholarship of disaster coverage says is that television will set the frame for the first 12 to 24 hours after any major event like this. Katrina, of course, lasted longer, and television set the frame for longer. But as you look at these videos, one of the things you notice is that we do what we do well. We show images of devastation. What we're not showing is the portion of Moore and of Oklahoma City city that was relatively, I use that word advisedly, undamaged by this tornado. And that's something that we... That's a kind of thing that we do as well. So there may, for example, be people in this country who think, having seen those images, that not only is the central portion of Moore gone, but that maybe major sections of Oklahoma City are gone. And that turns out in this particular case not to be the case. The other thing about this is if there is any group of news folk who are practiced at covering tornadoes, it has to be the folks in Oklahoma City. They are right in the middle of Tornado Alley. They have the best group of storm chasers in the country that are located down in Norman. They have the National Center for all this in Norman, Oklahoma. I mean, these folks are both practiced and knowledgeable. So to have them give us this portrait nationally is in some ways, I think, very, very good journalism, although it's not without its problems, of course.
In a situation like this, Ernest, it's understandable that television coverage goes wall to wall. But what we're almost starting to see is every time it rains, every time it snows, every storm is turning into the storm of the century. Why is that?
Well, I think it's because weather drives ratings, especially in local television. And it's something that you're seeing more and more of. More newscasts are leading their newscasts with weather as opposed to news. Sports in a lot of ways has been relegated to the end of the newscast, even if it's there at all in a lot of cases. And it's one of those things where, as Lee said, the images are powerful and you can see that, and the possibility of something like that happening also can be used as a way to drive ratings in situations like this. I mean, we saw it here in locally the night after this happened. I mean, all it was talking about was weather. I mean, you got very little news, very little anything else. It was all about the storms that were moving in and how those storms were in Oklahoma City, were in Moore before.
The other thing I think is happening, and this is a way deep, and I don't mean to go too far down this road. Mm-hmm. The weather's changing, even though we still as a country are not decided on the global climate change yeah. debate. The scientific community is certainly decided on the global climate change debate. And one of the things that's happening as a result of this is that weather is becoming news in a different way than it was, well, okay, it's hot out today, you might want to dress appropriately. I think all of those things are contributing to the technology, as you mentioned, Amy, yeah. are contributing to our ability to go wall to wall. There are some places I still don't think we're saying enough and we're doing enough. So, for example, one of the things that I picked up online, Second Screen Experience, is that Moore is not a wealthy community. The issue then becomes, how do these very middle-class folks who have lost everything recover? And what is their help going to be in recovering? That's a story I haven't seen reported yet. It's not a traditional part of the weathercast, but it needs to be a part of the news cycle.
The other story that just started coming out this morning, mm-hmm. I read it in the New York Times and again, and even some of the Oklahoma papers, is the fact that these schools do not have shelters. They were not built to have storm shelters, and there's no code in Moore, Oklahoma, or in a lot of places in the Midwest along Tornado Alley that require storm shelters in schools and homes and public buildings. And a lot of it is attributed to the fact that it costs. And so you can't require that these businesses and these communities do these things because home prices would be higher, business costs would be higher. So I think that's an issue, going back to what Lee was saying, mm-hmm. is something that needs to be addressed and needs to be talked about, because if we're going to continue to have storms like this, then there needs to be some sort of safety mechanism put in place whereby when you have new construction, as there will be in Moore, Oklahoma, yeah. that they'd be required to have
to begin to guard against
right.
future storms.
Right.
Well, Sunday, viewers of the Wichita NBC affiliate KSN saw something on the air that was a first, at least a first for the anchors there.
You know, J.D., in 20 years, I've never said this, yeah. but I think it's our time to go.
Dave,
I really do. We've been monitoring the conditions here downtown. So at this point, folks, we here at KSN are moving to our shelters. We are moving to our shelters.
Lee, I have to say, I have always wondered about the reporters. Yes, it's brave in some ways, but the ones who are running outside wanting to be the first ones, I've kind of joked sickeningly about the ones hanging sideways off of a stop sign during a hurricane. What is the message we send to our viewers and to our audience when we do that as journalists?
I think we send a bad message, and it's bad in a couple of ways. So if Aristotle were here, which he isn't, he would say that if courage is the middle ground, foolhardiness is an extreme you want to avoid. This not going to shelter, that's foolhardy. That's risking your life for no good purpose. Informing the public is a good purpose, but you're not going to be able to inform the public if you're dead and if your station is demolished.
Yeah.
So we sort of need to get our ducks in a row. The other way that we send this message is that we continue, and I saw this in the coverage of the tornado and more, we continue to air shots of cool cell phone video where people, instead of going to their safe room or at least to the bathroom where they can pull a mattress over their heads, have instead gone outside to take pictures of the tornado. That's a horrible message. And at some point, some person, a loved one probably, is going to say, you know, if my loved one hadn't done this stupid thing and gone out because they wanted to be on Eyewitness News and get this cool cell phone video, and we're going to get sued. We deserve to lose that suit. We are putting people in harm's way. We need to do a better job of thinking this ahead of thinking this through ahead of time and telling folks, I don't care how cool your cell phone video is, we don't want you to risk your life to get it, and we're not putting it on air.
And what these folks did at KSN is pretty admirable. They just left that radar up and they went straight and took shelter.
No, exactly. And I think over time that news organizations are probably going to come to the conclusion that it's better to be safe than to risk the lives of themselves, their employees, that sort of thing. But to go back to Lee's point, I think when you see all of these incidents happen, either they're Mother Nature or man-made, and people are out with their cameras and their cell phones and that sort of thing, that's a very dangerous situation. You saw some of that during the Boston Marathon bombing, where you had people who were actually turning toward the bomb instead of running away from the bomb. And It's one of those situations where I tell my friends when they're out or they're going into dangerous situations, look, when something's happening, you want to run. You want to see the news, not be the news.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's something that I think we in the media really need to step back and think about whether or not we want to put the public in danger by asking them to turn their videos in when something like this happens.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit and talk some about politics. Last week, we spoke at length about the controversies hanging on the Obama administration. And here we are a week later, and very little has changed. All three of those stories are still making news. Benghazi, the IRS, and the AP leak, all top headlines still. After our show last week, the acting director of the IRS stepped down. There were op-eds published over the weekend chiding ABC's John Carl for relying on summarized emails on the Benghazi talking points. And Attorney General Eric Holder recused himself from the AP case. But now there's word coming out, and we're learning about another case. The Justice Department is accusing Fox correspondent James Rosen of possibly being an aider and abettor or co-conspirator in the leaking of classified information. Lee, there are some subtle differences between this case and the subpoenaing of the AP records. Explain those subtle differences to us.
I'm not sure I can explain the subtle differences because some of the differences don't seem all that subtle to me. One of the way that I've heard it, the phrase best is we're indicting him for committing journalism. Mm-hmm. I don't find that particularly subtle or nuanced. And until I know more fact, the facts that I know indicate to me that's exactly what we're doing. We're accusing this guy of being a criminal for doing his job. As best I can figure out, he didn't steal anything. He didn't put in any wiretaps. I mean, he's done nothing clandestine to obtain this information. He obtained the information and then he went ahead and published/broadcast it. So we're going to indict him for doing journalism. And to me, as a citizen in a country that says it values the First Amendment, that's pretty scary.
Well, I think in this situation, you can go all the way back to the founding of the Republic, the Alien and Sedition Act. I mean, as soon as the First Amendment was passed, you had an Alien Sedition Act that was also passed to sort of curb it. So this is just a long line of that kind of situation going, where you have this tension between the press and the government centered around the threat to national security. And whenever the press goes over the line according to whatever administration or political power yeah. that happens to be in charge. As soon as the press goes over the line, they say, well, wait a minute, you know, what you're doing is a threat to national security. Therefore, we must take these steps in order to curb your First Amendment rights.
So the New Yorker's Ryan Liza tweeted about this, saying that the case against Fox's Rosen, in which the Obama administration is criminalizing reporting, makes all the other scandals right now look like giant nothing burgers. Is he right?
I don't think they look like giant nothing burgers. I think that the public is really very much in tune with what is going on with the IRS. I mean, and on any level, from just citizen to person who teaches about journalism, that is not a nothing burger scandal. That is clearly a government agency either being torqued or torquing itself into ways that are utterly inappropriate in a democratic society. I agree with Ernest. We have a very long, contentious history in this country of trying to decide what's in our national interest versus what is in national security. In a democracy, it is in your national interest to hold government to account, to try to make government be more open, to try to get government to admit what it's done. Okay, now we're back to the IRS, yes. So that the citizens can have some say about what that government should or shouldn't do. This is sort of the long tail, if you will, of 9/11. Now, when everything's get iffy, we're going to holler national security and think later. And I really do believe in this case that is precisely what's happened.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, and the other part I think that really resonates with the public is when you mentioned those three letters, IRS, they really sort of stand up and go, whoa, wait a minute, because people truly believe that the IRS has these magical powers to come in and do things to you that no other federal agency can do. And then when they see a case such as this where the IRS is actually doing something that, you know, regardless of whether you're Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal, you can't do that. And that's what really makes this case different from all the other scandals that happen to be going on right now.
Okay. Ernest, you said something earlier in the show that sports has a tendency to get relegated to the very end of every show. We're going to actually talk about sports now for a little bit, or at least the business of sports. Yesterday, ESPN cut an estimated 400 jobs from the 7,000 in its workforce. It's the first major staffing reduction there in about 4 years. The news seems surprising to me, at least, because it seems like we've been in an upswing and that jobs have been starting to come back in our industry. What's behind such a deep cut, do you think?
Well, I think what's, at least from the information that I've been able to read, is that ESPN, which is the profitable, very profitable part of the Disney Corporation, had to basically make a decision that we've got to cut as well, because the other parts of Disney are not making money. So Disney across the board said, okay, everybody's got to make some cuts. ESPN decided that they were going to do it in form of layoffs as opposed to salary reductions or furloughs or however else you could benefit cuts, yeah, those types of things. And what's striking about this is that just last week, ESPN entered into a major contract with the Southeastern Conference to form the SEC Network.
Mm-hmm. To great fanfare, especially around here.
Exactly. And that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So they've locked up the SEC. They've locked up the NFL. They locked up Major League Baseball. They've locked up the NBA. So they've got all of these
U.S. Open tennis,
two of the big majors in professional golf. So they've got all of these contracts. But they're laying off 400 workers. And most of those workers are on the technical side. They're not the stars and the people that you see on air. Mm-hmm. They're the people behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And a lot of them aren't the ones making a huge amount of money. So you're not going to see any kind of an impact on what they put out over the air on their technical side, but you're going to see a lot of it on the digital side. You're going to see a lot of it in the website. You're going to see a lot of it in those terms. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens here.
I want to go back to something that Ernest said earlier, because this is about ratings and it's also about business models. One of the stories, Amy, that you put up on the blog talks about the fact that in television right now, the only thing that people aren't time shifting or you know, scooting through in other ways, turns out to be live sports. It may become it. Live sports may become the last bastion of what we consider sort of old television, where everyone sits down in front of the TV, watches the event, and is inflicted upon or consumes or receives commercials mm-hmm. as part of that effort. Everything else, whether it's through technology or by the fact that people are becoming pickier about what they choose to watch, or the fact that the cable industry last year, for the first time ever, actually lost subscribers, all of that is that part of the business model is falling apart. What's left is live sports. And that's CNN's bread and butter. So they're, I think, are literally trying to shore up that part of the mouse house. The question that's out there, of course, is how much longer is this going to last? Because I'm not convinced that live sports is not going to, we're not going to find some other more clever way of doing it. And then that is going to go the way that most other broadcasting and before that print outlets have gone.
Yeah, and I think the other thing with this is that ESPN is about to get some competition. Fox Sports is in the process of starting its own network, mm-hmm. which starts in August. CBS Sports is now big into it. NBC Sports now has its own network, and it's also gone out and bought the Golf Channel, so they're trying to create their own sort of mini empire to sort of rival what ESPN is doing. So I think there's a combination of cost cutting because of the money they're expending on all of these contracts and the influx of competition.
There was some, I don't want to call it outcry, but there was some criticism out there yesterday, is there was very little reporting done on these cuts at ESPN, that some in the sports journalism field were really disappointed to see that ESPN's sports business beat reporter was mum on the topic, had tweeted more than 50 times during the course of the day. Yesterday, I went back and counted how many times during the day he tweeted, more than 50 times on different stories that he was covering, yet not a mention of anything. Is this his story to cover, or should it be coming from somewhere else? Do you need to report on what's going on in your own house, or no?
As I understand it, it came initially, the initial report was on Deadspin, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which is a very, very credible website, especially if you're a sports aficionado. I think it is his story to cover. I think it's one of those tiny drip, drip, drips about journalistic credibility that you lose. Every time you don't cover a story like this, even if it's in your own shop, you lose credibility and people start to ask, in essence, who else are you protecting? And so, yes, I do believe it's his story to cover. I understand completely that his corporate owners probably muzzled him. That, in my view, is a mistake.
And he's not the first journalist to run into this issue. I mean, this happens a lot, especially in our business. When bad news hits in journalism, whichever entity it happens to hit usually is the last one to report on it. Mm-hmm. So I think you're probably going to see something from ESPN at some point, but I didn't expect it to, this kind of information to come from ESPN. It would come from somewhere
from
else.
Outside. Well, up in Toronto, a video has surfaced of Conservative Mayor Rob Ford smoking something that by all accounts appears to be crack cocaine. Three journalists, John Cook of Gawker and the Toronto Star's Robin Doolittle and Kevin Donovan, attest to having watched that video several times each. Never mind the allegations of the mayor of North America's fourth largest city smoking crack, the story of the cell phone video itself is a fascinating secondary plot. Both Cook and the reporters from the Star say that they have worked with a broker for the person who owns the cell phone that the video is on, and that that person is demanding cash for full access to the video. The asking price is currently said to be in the six figures, and Gawker wants your help to help raise the money. It's using the crowdfunding site Indiegogo to raise the cash and has almost $115,000 in pledges already. Lee, you're our ethicist. Tell us, is this an innovative way to bring truth to power, or is it something else entirely?
Oh, it's innovative, all right, and probably unethical as heck for a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
First, American journalists say that we don't pay for news. If we're not paying for this, and if this isn't news, then I don't understand those two terms. So already there's strike one. Two, we're asking the public to help us fund this. if we aren't to keep watchdogging on government, I don't know what our purpose is, then nah, that dog doesn't hunt for me. And third, I find it really intriguing that no one, at least that I've been able to unearth, is talking about the actual accuracy of these images, which we all know could be altered in various ways. So I can't actually find a single ethical thing about it. And if the mayor of Toronto is or is not doing drugs in this point, there's got to be a different way, a better way, a more transparent way to get that story. And the Toronto newspaper, actually, which is a pretty good news organization, should go about it.
Yeah, I find this fascinating because we're not talking about is this actually true? Did the mayor actually do this? Is there any follow-up reporting on this? Where are those stories? We seem to be sort of fascinated about the fact that, you know, whoever has this cell phone image wants this money, and now all of a sudden they're asking the public, hey, contribute to this so mm-hmm. we can all see the mayor of Toronto smoke crack. It just seems like we've sort of lost our ethical compass here in terms of what is journalism, what is air, what is accurate, what is fair, and what is truth here.
So talk a little bit more about that, because the very first thing I thought of when I first heard about this story breaking wasn't about the craziness about that the crowdfunding for the release of the tape. My first thought was, this feels like 1990 all over again in Marion Barry in Washington, D.C. Talk about the differences, especially from the historical perspective, of how these two stories have been covered and how that has they compare.
Well, I think that from a historical perspective, when you talk about Marion Barry, you were talking about the mayor of Washington, D.C. He's an African-American mayor, the whole situation involving crack and how it was racialized and politicized at the time. You don't necessarily see that in this story. And that's a part that's really sort of shocking to me, is that you're talking about a political figure of a major city in North America, and no one's focusing in on the fact that he's committing a crime mm-hmm. if the information is true. But we can't verify it because the information is being held hostage by whoever has it
for ransom.
So it's sort of a very weird situation here. Law enforcement's not involved at this point at all.
We have had situations where people have offered what I tend to call bounties, mm-hmm. Back to the Wild West. This is a little bit of the Wild West, for information about, the one who comes to mind is Roger Ailes, or, you know, somebody else's private life. And to me, if a crime has not been committed, then that verges towards that way. People will give you the most amazing stuff. Whether it's true is another thing entirely. What this feels like to me is it's a lot more like the paparazzi than journalism. Paparazzi photographers get paid often enormous sums for getting pictures of people doing stuff. That's what it feels like.
Well, like always, we're out of time before we're out of things to talk about. Thanks to you for listening and watching. There's more background on today's topics on our links blog under the talk shows tab at kbia.org. You can also replay the show and leave comments for us there, or send them to us via email at kbia.org. RJI's Travis McMillan directs our show, and KBIA's Pat Akers handles the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to listen in next week. Mike McKean will be back. He, Ernest, and I will have another edition of Views of the News.